Okay, first of all, why do we need to learn to listen? Well, the thing is, in our society, we're very, very, of course, highly literate. But one of the things we do, quite understandably, is make a very clear distinction between communicating in speech and communicating in writing. We think of speaking as interactive, as personal. When we're talking to someone, even in quite a formal setting or whatever it might be, we can't help beginning to form an opinion of the speaker. What's this person like? And why is he or she telling me this? Or if it's obviously if it's somebody we know, we rely upon long-standing experience of interactions with this person. And depending on the context, we interpret what's being said. For example, if I'm sitting in a formal job interview and somebody makes a comment about me, I take it very seriously. I listen. If I'm in a party and we're all drinking and laughing and chatting and somebody, the same person says the same thing, I may well take it very differently. It may well be a joke. It may well be, you know, something else. So the context makes a great deal of difference to how it is we listen. With writing, however, we tend to think entirely of the content. In most cases, we don't think much about the writer. Occasionally we do. It might be if you're reading the newspaper or something, you might think, you know, what's this journalist like or something. But on the whole, when we're confronted with a piece of writing, the text is what it's all about. We can perfectly appreciate and understand and enjoy an anonymous piece of writing, something we don't even know not who wrote it or when it was written or anything else. We can still enter into it and appreciate it. But we tend not to mix those two things. We tend to keep them very much apart. The written language is there. It's essentially about content. And the spoken language is here, and it's essentially about understanding the person, interacting, developing an interpretation as we go along, and so on. Of course, in our society, writing is essentially made simply to be read silently. Up until quite recently, reading was always done aloud. Even if you were sitting reading a novel, you know, out in the park somewhere, you would read aloud. And certainly in biblical times, writing was done in order that speech could be given to people who weren't there. So those of you who were at the Amos studies, for example, may remember that I talked a bit about how Amos's text is essentially a record of what he said to the people. And the whole Bible's like that. In some way or another, all the books in the Bible were written in order to be read. There's probably the most interesting and I find fascinating example is St. Paul with his letters. And you can imagine Paul, you can virtually hear him. He would appoint somebody as an amanuensis, you know, a secretary to write down, and Paul would walk about and talk. He wants to say something to the Corinthians and he's talking to them like this, and the amanuensis is madly trying to copy it all down. And when it's all down, then Paul has a look at it and says, okay, now take it off to them. And somebody goes, travels over to Corinth and reads it aloud in the church. And just to give one interesting example, there's one text in which you can virtually hear this in the scripture itself. Paul wanted to tackle the Corinthians because they were wondering about where their faith was. Was it in Jesus? Was it in Paul? Was it in Peter? You know, who was it? Who was the object of their faith? And Paul gets a bit worked up about this. And can't you see him sort of walking around the room and saying, did Paul die on the cross for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? No. I thank God I baptized none of you, except Crispus and Gaius. So no one can say you were baptized in my name. And then he corrects himself. Oh, yes. Yes, I did baptize the household of Stephanus. But beyond that, I don't think I baptized anybody. That in 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1. It's very much the spoken language. Paul talking to the Corinthians and his faithful writer putting them all down in order to go and read them. So, we're dealing with text, and in the case of Mark, and in the case of all the biblical texts, we're dealing with texts which were made to be read aloud. And we're not used to that. We're not used to listening to written language read aloud. And so, even though, of course, most of the scripture isn't quite as conversational as Paul's words there, nonetheless, we still need to learn the habit of listening as though this writer is actually there and talking to us. Of course, it's difficult. We have to imagine a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of our even very faithful readers don't really understand that. They're much more concerned about simply getting the words right rather than getting a sense of, you know, what is in the scripture. There are exceptions, yes, but that's right, of course. So the focus of this session is listening. How do we learn to listen? In particular, how do we learn to listen to Mark? And in order to try to develop that, as I say, I want to say a few things now about what a gospel is and what we're listening for in a gospel, and then what sort of person Mark was and what he was trying to say. Okay. So, what is a gospel? When you think about it, there are many, many, possibly even hundreds, certainly dozens, of types of writing that we recognize. You know, journalism, academic articles, novels, etc., etc., throughout our world. Four of them are called gospels. Nothing else. Nothing else is called a gospel. There are only four of them. So what are we dealing with in this very unusual, peculiar form of writing? I think most of us tend naturally and understandably to think of gospel as a biography. I'm sure you've all read biographies, you know, some famous person or other, and you've read biography. Actually, although there is obviously a biographical aspect to the Gospels, they're not biographies in the sense that we're used to biographies. Modern biographies, for example, need to be very well researched. And if the author makes a claim or a statement about something or other about this person's life, it has to be well established. There has to be good evidence for it. And if there isn't, the author will normally say, you know, I'm not sure about this, but maybe actually hedge it about, because he or she doesn't want you to take this as sort of, you know, real historical data. The other thing about a biography is of interest to us is that writers and we as readers tend to be interested in the totality of the person's life. Quite often biographies will start, you know, with great-great-great-granddad and gradually come down the generations. All the various people that the main character mixed with, what he or she did in detail. Only some bits of which are really highly significant, other bits of which are just sort of maybe ordinary family life behind the scenes. To give a bit of background to somebody who's, say, a great politician who's well-known as a public person, but the biographer likes to put in some of these details of his or her family life, so you get some sense of what sort of person we're dealing with. Now, the Gospels, Gospel writers don't think like that. Yes, Matthew does go right back and give the whole genealogy of Jesus, but essentially what the Gospel writers are doing, each of them in his own way, is trying to tell us what we should think about this person. Not, here are all the facts, you know, make up your mind for yourself. But let me tell you, this person, Jesus, meant this or that or whatever it might be. The gospel writer, each of them, has his own particular point that he wants to make about the person of Jesus. And therefore, we've got four gospels which are quite different because they're written by four different people with four different interests who are writing for very different audiences to listen to. They're not writing for the world, they're writing for a specific audience. Last year we looked at Matthew and looked at how Matthew was writing to specific congregations which were struggling with the faithful, you know, the traditional Jews who were rejecting the idea of the Christian Messiah. And Matthew was writing to them and he laid out very carefully a sort of theology, if you like, of this person Jesus, so that the people in these congregations that Matthew was familiar with could be strengthened and encouraged and say, yes, now I know what to do, and so on and so forth. Luke, we know, was a physician, the early equivalent of a sort of GP, and he was very interested in people's physical responses, emotional development, and so on and so forth. And he was very interested, particularly interested in how Jesus was transforming the physical lives and mental lives of people. And he wants to give us a picture of this extraordinary man who, with the power of God, can transform human lives in this way. John, of course, very different. John, you can't help feeling, is a really powerful intellect, and he's a real philosopher and theologian. And he's sort of sitting back and saying, let me put this in the big, universal picture. Let me put this Jesus into a sort of a universal context. And John is a very powerful and deep thinker. And each of them, as I say, is trying to show in his gospel what he thinks is important for his particular audience. Not for the world, not for the whole world, except possibly John, certainly. Not writing for the whole world, but writing for a particular group of people, just as Paul was writing to the Corinthians as a particular sort of people. So that brings us to Mark. Now with Mark, we've got a completely different type of book. He begins by saying, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Interestingly, Mark was the first gospel written. And interestingly, he was the first one ever to use the term gospel to apply to a life of. Up until then, and afterwards, people like Paul used the gospel as a theological concept. Mark's talking about it as a life picture. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We often translate the word, comment on the gospel as meaning good news, which of course it does. Sometimes glad tidings. But they don't quite capture the excitement of it. Actually, it's something like fantastic news or mind-blowing news. And in fact, I read one wonderful translation by a particular individual who starts off his translation of Mark's gospel with the beginning of the shout of joy about Jesus Christ. Isn't that a lovely, lovely picture? This is exciting stuff, folks. This is amazing. And throughout the text of Matthew's gospel, there's excitement. You haven't got that great, powerful mind of John. You haven't got that careful, orderly teaching of Matthew. You haven't got that physical, personal orientation of Luke. You've got a guy, Mark, who is totally thrown by the sheer excitement of the life of this man. So, who was Mark? Well, as in the case of so many Bible writers, not just gospel writers, we don't know, really. He was traditionally associated with either the John Mark, who's mentioned in Acts, who was a sort of disciple of Paul's, but fell out with Paul a bit. And there was also a Mark who was connected to Peter. And traditionally, it was assumed back in the early church, it was assumed that this Mark was one of those, either Peter's disciple, and some early commentators, bishops and people who commented on the scriptures, said, this man Mark is trying to recapture Peter's memories of Jesus. It could be. I've got another idea, which I think, to me, makes more sense. I can't prove it historically, but it's certainly not contrary to any historical evidence we have. And that is that Mark was a young man who was a hanger-on of Jesus. Not a disciple, he was too young, but he was a hanger-on. Throughout the Gospels, Mark and all the other Gospels, there's constant mention of crowds following Jesus. He is always surrounded by crowds. And he had to withdraw sometimes just to be alone with his disciples to get away from all the crowds. And I suspect Mark was one of those crowds. And I suspect he was a 20-year-old. And he was fascinated by this guy. There is a traditional link with Mark, which, again, the early church has made. In the story of Jesus' arrest in Gethsemane, in Mark's gospel only, it's mentioned that there was a young man there clad in a loincloth, and they tried to grab him, and he ran away naked. And traditionally, people have said, I think that might have been Mark. I reckon probably was, because I reckon he was hanging around all the time. And he was a young man, it says quite clearly here. So I think we're dealing with, a 20-year-old who's fascinated. Imagine what, you think your impressions of people when you were 20, learning about life and understanding. And here's this absolutely astonishing, amazing man that he can't quite understand, but he's totally excited by. And he's just, you know, living day to day the experience. Never quite works out who he is or what he is. Interestingly, in Mark's Gospel, which was written about 30 years later when he was sort of, if I'm right, when he was sort of middle-aged, and he was thinking back, you know, let me tell you what it was like to be there, he doesn't try to explain any of Jesus' teaching, because I don't think he understood it. Matthew gives us the whole Sermon on the Mount, for example, very carefully organized, beautifully laid out, very systematic. I don't think Mark understood. He was just blown over. But it was too much for him. And what he's trying to do, I think, in his gospel is say, this was what it was like. Imagine just being there, trying to understand what this amazing guy is on about, trying to understand what he's doing, making sense of it all. He's a wonderful man, absolutely, totally engaging, but blows my mind. I can't quite cope with him. And I think that is very much the mood of Mark, the gospel of Mark. As I say, he says very little about Jesus' teaching. He often says Jesus was teaching, and he taught them about so-and-so, but he doesn't tell us what Jesus said about it. That was just the topic of his teaching. And I could well imagine this young man sitting there saying, God, you know, while Jesus is talking away, he's saying, God, he's talking about, I don't know, the Messiah and the foretold Messiah and Jewish gospel, scriptures or something like that. And, you know, this is just amazing. What teaching? He's amazing. He's teaching. One of the interesting things about Mark that you will notice, and in fact, the first time I ever really responded to the Gospel of Mark, I don't know, I was about 18, 20 or something, reading it through, and I suddenly thought, this Jesus never stops. He's just always on the go. He goes, he does something here, and then Mark says, immediately he did so-and-so, or, and then he does this. Straight away, he does so-and-so. There's a Greek word meaning straight away, immediately, and Mark actually uses it more than any other of the gospel writers, in fact, any of the other Bible writers. He's got this, you know, Jesus is zam, bam, 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 on he goes, round and round like this. I suddenly thought, it suddenly struck me, I was reading this, and I'd read several gospels, you know, various times and so on and so forth, and I was reading Mark through, and I suddenly thought, this writer doesn't quite know who this guy is. He's struggling to understand him. And then suddenly the book takes on a different feel. There's no lessening of Jesus' appeal. He's powerful. There's no speculating, guessing what he might be doing because Mark can't understand it. He just says, he's doing this. It's up to you to decide, you know, what it's all about. But he doesn't stop. He just moves and on and on and on and on. We see Jesus very rarely. We see him occasionally withdrawing to pray, but we don't really see him relaxing or anything else. In fact, you know, if you have a big public figure, for example, as you know, of general interest, sometimes on telly or wherever, you'll have a talking head talking about this person, and other times you'll have a sort of day in the life of. And I think what Mark is trying to do is to give us a day in the life of, as it were, not just one day, of course, but, you know, he's saying, look, of course he would have thought, of course he would have worked things out for himself and so on and so forth. But I think he's being honest and saying, I may be wrong. This was what it was like. Let me pass on to you this shout of joy of the life of Jesus. And it's up to you to make out what you want of it. We'll come back to that later. I think it's very evident in the resurrection scene, but we'll come back to that. Yeah. So, yeah, I think he's trying to say, you know, experience it, guys. Come with me. And if he really was, as tradition says, the man who escaped, you know, the young man who ran away naked when Jesus was... he was, of course it would. Yeah.
Mark, could I ask a question? I find that quite exciting, what you're saying. And how does it stand in relation to the idea that the writer of Mark was setting down an oral tradition, and namely the, I think I call it the Q tradition?
Mm-hmm. The biblical scholarship doesn't associate the Q with Mark. Q is a sort of an unknown source for gospel information that Luke and Matthew drew on. But they clearly drew on Mark. He was the first one anyway. Mm. And what they're trying to do is to edit and extend and develop his gospel, but also perhaps drawing on Q. But Mark didn't. As far as we know, the Q was for Mark, was for Matthew and Luke. Yep. It's interesting, you'll see sometimes, and we'll be talking about the disciples in a minute, but for example, where the disciples, in many cases in Mark, they're thick as two planks, you know, they just don't understand what Jesus is saying. And Jesus keeps saying to them, don't you understand? Why is it so impossible? And what's very interesting is many of those passages, if you see the same passages in Matthew particularly, and to a lesser extent in Luke, they actually soften them a bit. They say, and the disciples, you know, were amazed at his teaching, and they understood what he was talking about. Mark was saying that they didn't, mate. They were walking around saying... Can we have one of those readings, the Mark 10, 13 to 16, please? What I want to illustrate here is, in many cases, Mark gives lots of simple detail of the sort of thing that somebody who was physically present may well have been impressed by. And you'll meet that quite a lot in Mark, much more than you do in the other Gospels. Would you like to read this one?
People were bringing little children to Jesus to have him touch them, but the disciples rebuked them. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to them, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as them. I tell you the truth, anyone who does not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." And he took the children in his arms, put his hands on them, and blessed them.
Isn't there a sort of reality about that? This, you can just see it happening, can't you? Interesting. A similar thing happens with Mark 2, 1 to 12. Thanks, Nathan.
For those reading along, I'm reading from the New King James Version, so there may be a few words that are slightly different.
Okay.
And again he entered Capernaum after some days, and it was heard that he was in the house. Immediately many gathered together, so that there were no longer room to receive them, not even near the door. And he preached the word to them. Then they came to him, bringing a paralytic, who was carried by four men. And when they could not come near him because of the crowd, they uncovered the roof where he was. So when they had broken through, they let down the bed on which the paralytic was lying. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven to you." And some of the scribes were sitting there, reasoning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak blasphemies like this? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" But immediately, when Jesus perceived in his spirit that they reasoned thus within themselves, he said to them, "Why do you reason about these things in your hearts? Which is easier, to say to the paralytic, 'Your sins are forgiven you,' or to say, 'Arise, take up your bed and walk'? But that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "I say to you, arise, take up your bed, and go to your house." Immediately he arose, took up the bed, and went out in the presence of them all, so that all were amazed and glorified God, saying, "We never saw anything like this."
Mm-hmm. Isn't there an immediacy about that? You can, you know, this is a guy who was there. They couldn't get in. There was no room, even near the door. You know, little details like that. This is a guy who was there, you know, who saw it. And there's a lot of that in Mark. A lot of those passages that you can feel and see and hear what was going on. There's no attempt to explain or anything else. It's just saying this is what they said. How did he know that Jesus knew what the scribes were thinking? Well, I suspect, you know, the scribes are sort of talking about and Jesus picks them up, and Mark says, "Oh gosh, he even knows what they're thinking." You know, he's there. Now, you will say, no doubt, there are parts of his gospel which he wouldn't have been there. It was only the disciples. Transfiguration, for example. We know that the young man wasn't there. But what I think of is quite likely, quite possible, is that, first of all, if Mark was one of the hangers or one of the groupies of Jesus, the disciples would have known him. And he was so impressed, so overwhelmed by Jesus, the disciples would have warmed to him. And I think that with things like the Transfiguration, there are a few parts in Mark which clearly is just the disciples were there, not Mark the writer. And I reckon the disciples told him, or maybe he asked them. And because of the sort of man he was, young man he was, and because of the disciples' relationship with him, I think they would gladly tell him. And I think that's probably where he got that sort of information from. It's not a sort of mysterious insight into amazing things. I think it's something quite practical. The older guys taking on this young man, encouraging him, saying, hey, let me tell you when we went up the mountain with Jesus, this is what happened. And, you know, Mark saying, wow, God, you know, come on, tell me. It's extraordinary. And then that becomes then part of Mark's impression of what Jesus was like, what Jesus did. And, you know, it may well be that for, you know, 25 years he didn't even think about writing it down. It was only later he began to say, hang on, people who knew Jesus are dying and, you know, the generation's passing and so on. I'd better give this, give it to the world.
He was quite old.
He would have been, it's not exactly known, as in pretty well all these things, you know, exactly when the gospel was written, but it was probably about 65 AD. In other words, about 30 years after Jesus died. So if he was 20 when Jesus died, he's 50, something like that. And I think at a certain point, because of the way he starts, you know, this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, he decided that he needed to let the world know. Because, yes, he could have been, as you say, sitting around reminiscing with his children.
Yes.
And then suddenly, hey, hang on a sec. We need a lot more people. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was your age, sort of thing. Yes.
Like, Dad, why don't you write your memoirs?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes.
Also, by that time, many of the apostles would be dead.
Yes.
One of the few still alive who would have witnessed.
Probably not one of the few, but certainly one of a dwindling number. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's no doubt why he thought. If somebody doesn't write this down, it's all going to be forgotten. Two generations, it'll be forgotten. Yeah, that's right.
The timing too, isn't it, Mark? I mean, it was sort of written around the time of the first persecutions of Christians.
Yes.
When the Emperor Nero.
Yes.
That's right.
For the fires of Rome.
Yep. Yep. There's a couple of hints in the Mark's Gospel itself, and more in the others, that the Romans are at work and troubling the audience of the gospel, and they need some encouragement and some strength. And yeah, that's right. Okay, let's think about just a couple of the aspects of the way in which Mark presents his story. As I said, I want to talk about the way he presents the disciples, Jesus' interaction with the disciples. Interestingly, there's nowhere in Mark's Gospel in which the disciples, you know, sort of say, now we understand. They never understand. Three times Jesus is with them in a boat. This is unique to Mark. Three times, and each time it ends with Jesus saying, don't you understand? You know, what have I got to do? When I fed the people, you know, how many loaves were there? How many fish were there? And they would say, there were, you know, five loaves, two fish, and so on and so on. Well, don't you understand? Can't you see? Says Jesus. And the disciples sort of don't. They get a bad press from Mark on the whole. They struggle the whole way through. Now, why should this be?
Because they've never experienced miracles.
Of course not. And don't forget that if my picture of Mark is right, he didn't understand either. So what Mark is saying to us, look, even these mature guys whom he called and who were very keen, the one good thing that they do in Mark is they eagerly follow him. So they're very keen, They're not like the scribes who are sort of picking, you know, arguments and finding fault and so on. They're really keen, but they really don't quite understand. And I think what Mark is letting us see is this is very, very difficult stuff. This isn't just a simple, oh, I believe X, Y, Z, that's fine. It's mind-blowing. It really takes you, you know, beyond your own normal human capacities. And I think Mark sees, he doesn't portray it in detail, but I think Mark sees the disciples struggling to understand just as he did. So even though they're much older than he, they're more mature, they're, you know, Jesus' close friends and so on and so forth, they should understand, even they can't really understand. So what Mark is presenting to us is a really powerful challenge. And one of the things I think about listening to the Gospel of Mark is it's very helpful sometimes to think, what would I do in that position? Or what do I do now in my position? How do I respond to what Jesus is doing? You know, he cures this guy let down through the ceiling, and, you know, miraculously cures him and so on and so forth, and makes a theological point at the same time. What would I have done? And how would I feel? How would I have responded? And how do I respond now when I hear that story? And I think that's a very important part of listening to the Gospel of Mark, is that our own response. And I think what Mark is doing is putting it out there and saying, make of it what you can. He's not telling us, Matthew is very carefully, systematically telling us, John is telling us in very deep and profound theological, philosophical ways. Luke, a bit more like Matthew in that sense, but nonetheless laying it all out. This is what it means, understand this, this is who Jesus is, and so on and so forth. Mark is just saying, there's the picture, it's up to you. You respond. Listening hint one, when you hear a passage being read, say in the church, think, what's happening here? Who are the characters involved? What are they doing? And what's Mark responding to them? You know, what does he think about them? Can we tell him? Of course, you can't always tell that. But it's interesting to listen with that in mind. And then finally, to say, and how would I react? What does that do for me? I think that's very important. I think most of all, when we come to the idea of the disciples not understanding and it being left open to them whether they develop a powerful, real faith or what, Mark doesn't resolve that. And I think most powerfully in the story of the resurrection. Mark's story of the resurrection finishes in verse 8 of chapter 16. The two, on resurrection day, the two Marys go to the tomb, they find it open, there's a man there, dressed in white, who tells them Jesus is risen. Go to Galilee and tell his disciples that he's going before them. And the women ran away, and they didn't say anything to anybody because they were afraid. Full stop. Lots of things have been added over the years to that, but that is the end of Mark. And I think that's Mark saying, you know, will the disciples meet him? Or will they just say, you know, we've had enough, we never understood this fellow, or whatever it might be? What's going to happen? And if he does meet them, what's going to happen? And interestingly, by then, a lot of people, probably a lot of his readers, would have known the oral history, you know, the tradition of what had happened to people like Peter and so on. And they say, so they've responded. But Mark is not telling us, or to us or the disciples, how they should respond, saying, it's open. Jesus is coming to meet you in Galilee, full stop, that's it. And I think our response to the resurrection in that way can actually be quite powerful. We can easily get, and of course there are some wonderful stories in the other Gospels about, you know, Jesus confronting Mary in the garden and so on and so forth. Fabulous stuff. But there's also that real raw, you know, he's going before you, go and see him. It's up to you.
There's no embellishment.
No embellishment. No. So that's what he says about the disciples. And the other thing I want to look at, yes, we've got a few moments, is how Jesus interacts with the crowds. Now, it's interesting that, and we heard this in the passage that Nathan read for us, whenever Mark comments on the crowd's reaction, the crowd, I'm not talking about the religious leaders, but the general crowd, they're all absolutely astounded. You know, we've never heard anything like this before. This is amazing. And it's always that sort of reaction. And I think that's partly because that was Mark's reaction. He was with them. He felt the same. You know, God, what is this? This is incredible. And so always the crowds respond to Jesus in that very positive, extraordinary way. And I think Mark is putting that in front of us as one of the options. You know, you don't have to understand him. You don't have to know all about him. You don't have to be an intimate disciple who meets with him every day and, you know, shares meals with him and so on and so forth. Just listening to him and seeing what he does can be absolutely extraordinary.
That's what it's called faith.
And I think that's right. Mm. And I think that's what Mark is saying to us. Put yourself, yes, in one way he's saying put yourself in the position of the disciples. In another way he's saying put yourself in the position of just the ordinary bloke in the street who's sort of, you know, hanging on with Jesus and going around and so on and so forth. And this is what your response will be like. But of course it's very different for the, just one lovely verse in Mark 7. The people's admiration was unbounded. He has done all things well, they said. Isn't that terrific? Lovely piece. Inevitably, we can tell from all the Gospels that whenever there was a crowd of people like that, there were religious leaders as well. And the religious leaders are always in Mark. There's none of this Nicodemus in John who sort of comes and believes. The religious leaders are all fault-finding, and they're all carping about what Jesus said. And so, for example, now some scribes thought, Nathan read, how can this man talk like this? He's blaspheming. And another passage, the scribes and Pharisees asked the disciples, why does he, Jesus, eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why does he mix with the riffraff? And another place, the scribes are saying, he's possessed by the prince of demons. It's only by the prince of demons he can cast demons out. He must be possessed. There we've got, if you like, Mark showing us how a religious conviction, as in the case of the scribes and Pharisees, can blind us, make us totally insensitive to the extraordinary power of this man's presence and his actions. And even though the crowd are sort of wandering about, you know, totally astounded by what he's doing, the scribes and Pharisees are doing this, oh, he's doing this wrong, he's doing that, you know, we could pick him this, so on and so forth. And I think there's, if you like, a warning there from Mark. Don't let your religious faith, in inverted commas, blind you to this extraordinary man. He's blown all those things away. He's you know, gone way beyond them. Don't try to pull him back and hold him down. So I think there's, in those three things, with the disciples, the crowds, and with the religious leaders, Mark gives us almost an invitation, obviously not explicit, but an invitation to respond. Are you like the crowds? Are you like the scribes and Pharisees, whose religion has blinded them? Are you like the disciples, who really want to follow Jesus, but really can't quite cope? And if so, how are you going to respond? Now, I think if we learn to listen to the Gospel of Mark being read like that, it won't happen every week, but I think there'll be some times when you'll feel, God, yes, this is Mark inviting me to respond. And how am I going to respond? And this can be a really powerful thing. It's way going back to what I said at the beginning. This is way beyond a neat biography written out and the sort of facts being told. This is much more like somebody talking to us and saying, look, if you were there, you would have thought this. And inviting you, as it were, to be there and to enter into it. So if we listen to the speaking voice, as it were, of Mark, I think there's a great deal for us to learn. What I'd like to do now is to read two or three passages, depending on time. We've only got a quarter of an hour left. And just get you sort of practicing listening and making any comments you'd like. But so it's a little bit of sort of practicing what we've been talking about. This is right near the beginning of markets. It just reminded me, I should have said this before. There are normally notes for these sessions which are made up. Because the office opened only today, I didn't think it was fair to ask John to prepare them in time. What I will do is email the notes to you, but also we will be producing some hard copies, and if you'd really like hard copies of the notes, please let me know. Otherwise, in the next few days, I'll email to you all. I think I've got all your emails. I'll just send the notes to you for looking at online, okay? Okay, from Mark chapter 1. And as he walked by the Sea of... practice listening. As he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men." They immediately left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little farther from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were also in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them. And they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants, and they went after him. Then they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and taught.
It's a very strange cold call, isn't it?
Yes. And it tells you something about the disciples. You know, they're so keen. Yeah, let's leave Dad and the servants. Let's go, you know.
Maybe it was Jesus' magnetism.
I'm sure it was. Yeah, yeah.
And like the use of the word immediately.
Yep.
Yes.
Like it's not then they went.
No, that's right. Immediately.
They didn't come and
say why.
Yeah, right.
Show me what.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Who are you? Why should we call you? Yeah.
They probably would have known about Jesus, though, wouldn't they?
You would expect so.
You would expect that they would have
heard
about
this man.
This
amazing man, yes.
When he came up and asked them to follow.
Wow. Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they may have thought, oh gosh, you know, he's calling me. Wow. Yes.
I wonder what they thought of fishers of men.
Yes. Yes.
It's a hard concept, isn't
it? It is, isn't it? Going fishing for people. Yes.
But this is Jesus building his team, right?
Yeah.
So, and I'm thinking of Louise, who's just built a team, a hospitality team, and she said to a couple of people, "Be on my team." And people said, "Yeah, cool." And so it just feels like the same sort of thing. So as with you, and I sort of feel like they must have known at some level what he was like, and that he was probably going to, you know, build a team of people. I don't know how common that was at the time, but
it was fairly common, because in Mark, but in, I can't remember any one of the other gospels anyway, a couple of times it said, you know, why do your disciples do this when other people's disciples are doing that? So clearly it was
a kind of normal thing to do in that respect.
If you were an eminent religious figure,
right,
you had disciples. Yeah. I think it's nice, helpful occasionally, just to remind yourself, you know, the beginning of the shout of joy about Jesus Christ. I think that's a lovely thing. That's what Mark's on about. Right, Mark chapter 8. Now Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asked his disciples, saying to them, "Who do men say that I am?" So they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others, one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "You are the Christ." Then he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. That happened quite a lot through Mark. You know, he tells, cures a man of demon possession and says, don't tell anybody. But the man can't be stopped, and he goes out and tells everybody. But Jesus says to him, don't tell him. Interesting, why? Then he strictly warned them they should tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly. Now, here you get another picture of the disciples. Peter has just said, "You are the Christ." And then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." So even Peter's just reached that great pinnacle, and suddenly he's down here. He's messed it up. That's so typical of the disciples, but that, and Peter is the epitome of them all. Yeah.
So really that's about someone saying, "I understand that you are the Christ, but fundamentally I still don't understand."
Mm.
It's like the many layers of understanding.
Mm. Yeah, and you can imagine Peter saying, "Look, you know, don't be so pessimistic, Lord. You know, why should you be killed? You know, that sort of thing." Yeah.
God's anointed shouldn't die in such an ignoble way.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Peter, I like that. Peter rebuked him. Peter told him off. You know, come on, Jesus, don't talk like this. Well, there we are, folks. That's a brief introduction to Mark, and my main concern is that from now on you will listen creatively, definitely, definitively. Also, of course, not just when you're hearing it read, also when you're reading for yourself. And it is, if you can do it without being sort of regarded as a bit of a nutter, reading it aloud for yourself can actually be very good. But go away somewhere else and do it, you know. But yeah, so I hope that's a start for the year, and that you keep on, you know, rediscovering this. There are hundreds of other things that we could have talked about, no time to do so. If you yourself, you know, discover new things and so on and so forth, please let me or others know, because it's all, you know, it's all a year-long process, so.